If you would please join me in 2 Kings chapter 18, verse number 13, where it says this: In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. Now let's identify some of the components here. 14th year of King Hezekiah in Kings seems to always be dated from when he became crown prince. So the year that we're looking at here is 715 BC. Now at that time, Sennacherib was not yet fully king of Assyria. His father, Sargon II, was the actual king of Assyria. So what's probably being done here is an anachronistic use of the title king. We see this all the time in historical literature. For example, somebody will say, "This is the log cabin in which President Lincoln was born." Well, he wasn't president when he was born. So is that an inaccurate statement? No, it's just taking into effect an important later historical reality. So Sennacherib will eventually be king of Assyria. Right now, though, he's the crown prince. And this seems to be what happened, is that when Sargon II took over the Assyrian Empire in 722 BC, he was not universally accepted in that role. And so he had to take care of business closer to home for several years. When the middle of the 17s rolled around, he was still trying to take care of some difficulties up in Assyria proper, up in the northern portion of Assyria, on his northern areas. Apparently, he decided to have his son, Sennacherib, go down and secure the rest of the ethnic Israelis on the southern end of his empire. Because remember, he'd already taken the northern country of Israel back in 723 and had sent all of the ethnic Israelis from that region up into the northern portions of Assyria and had deported into Israel other people groups. So he'd already pretty much secured everything that used to be northern Israel as solid Assyrian territory. But Judah was resistant. And Judah was effectively next door to Egypt, which was a potential adversary of the growing new Assyrian Empire. So Sargon and his crown prince, Sennacherib, are going to want to take control of Judah. So in 715 BC, Sennacherib takes the Assyrian army and sweeps through what used to be northern Israel, down the coast, past Gaza, which had at one time been under Judean control, but which falls very quickly to the Assyrians. And he sweeps around to the southwest flank of Judah. Now, why does he do it that way? To make sure, I think, that the Judeans can't reach out to Egypt for assistance. That's the intent. And so this is what the rest of 2 Kings 18 says at this point. Verse number 14. Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish. Lachish is one of the fortified cities to the southwest of Jerusalem, down in the southwestern region of Judah. And that's where the Assyrian army has set up their base. And he was saying, I've done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. So Hezekiah has a moment of weakness, I think, here. He doesn't immediately call upon God. Instead, he tells the Assyrian king, I'm sorry that I have resisted you. I will be a tributary. You tell me what you want in tribute, and I'll pay it. And so the king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of silver. Now, that's a lot of money. Each talent represents later about 6,000 days' wages. So we're talking of the silver, over $100 million worth of buying power. And 30 talents of gold is roughly equivalent to 300 talents of silver. So we're talking several hundred millions of dollars that the king of Assyria wants out of Judah. Now, why that much? Because they've resisted for probably about 8 or so years becoming part of the Assyrian Empire. So there's some back tribute that's included in that. Now, what does Hezekiah do? Again, we've got to do a slight critique of him. Instead of immediately turning to God and begging for assistance, he does what he can to pay this debt off. Verse 15, Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of He Who Is and in the treasuries of the king's house. So he dips into the royal reserves and pays as much of this as he can. And apparently it's not enough yet. At that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of He Who Is and from the doorposts that Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. So he makes up the difference by scraping off the gold coating that was on the temple doors. And this he sends to Sennacherib, hoping that it will be sufficient. Well, it is not. Because verse 17 says that the king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris, which in the Isaiah passage, it has Rabshakeh. These are all just titles that are used here. We're talking about the top military commanders. He sent this Rabshakeh with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. So Sennacherib doesn't just simply want the tribute. He actually wants Jerusalem to be surrendered. Now, that's not going to happen because God has already said in prophecies that the Assyrians will come close to Jerusalem, but they will never be able to take it. At this point, I think I'd like us to switch over to Isaiah's history of these events. And so let's take it up in verse number 2 of Isaiah 36. The king of Assyria, that'd be Sennacherib, the crown prince actually, sent the Rabshakeh, that's the top military commander, from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem with a great army. So we've got a little unit, a decent sized unit, that's been spun off from the Assyrian army that is to the southwest of Judea. And so this unit spins off and comes to Jerusalem. Rest of verse 2. He stood by the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the washer's field. Now, exactly where that's at, we're not going to be super clear on that. It's probably southern part of ancient Jerusalem. There came to him Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna, the secretary, and Yoah, the son of Asaph, the recorder. So we have people who are highly placed in the kingdom of Judah, but they're not the king. It's not the king himself. He is not going at this point to come out and talk to this military commander. He sends his underlings to talk to him. Verse number 4. The Rabshakeh said to them, "You say to Hezekiah, 'Thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, on what do you rest this trust of yours? Do you think that mere words are strategy and power for war? In whom do you now trust that you've rebelled against me?'" So the question is being put out, why do you think that you can resist the Assyrian king? Who is it that you think that you can put your trust in? Now listen to the next verse. Verse 6. "Behold, you're trusting in Egypt, the broken reed of a staff that will pierce the hand of any man who leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him." So this is, again, probably reinforcement for why the Assyrian army has swept around to the southwestern flank of Judah. It's to cut them off from any potential reaching out to the king of Egypt. This new dynasty is a potential rival to the growing new Assyrian empire. So Rabshakeh says, certainly you're not putting your trust in Egypt. They can't help you. But listen to the next verse, verse 7. "And if you say to me, 'We trust in he who is our God.'" So if you're going to now tell me that you believe in your God named Yahweh, "is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has removed, saying to Judah and Jerusalem, 'You shall worship before this altar?'" Now, what's that a reference to? That is a reference to the fact that when Hezekiah first came completely to the throne as the solo king, he set up a revival in Judah, and also in some parts of northern Israel, to get rid of all the other worship idols, all the other worship sites, some of which were supposedly devoted to Yahweh, to He Who Is. Now, up in the northern kingdom, those altars were devoted to the golden calf cult of this version of God. In other places, Baal had been kind of merged with the idea of He Who Is, and were being used as kind of a synchronistic approach to worship. And so this Assyrian leader is aware of that recent revival where Hezekiah went through and got rid of all of those other altars. Definitely happened down in Judah, but it happened in some places in northern Israel. And so he says, hey, if you guys, because he's talking to leaders in the Hezekiah kingdom, if you guys think that you can put your trust in He Who Is, maybe you ought to realize that Hezekiah has insulted He Who Is by getting rid of a whole bunch of his altars and trying to say that only in his little temple, on the Temple Mount next to his palace, is the only place that you can worship. So they're twisting things around to their own purposes here. The Assyrians are trying to turn the Judeans against Hezekiah, as if Hezekiah is the problem. Continuing, verse number 8. "Come now, make a wager with my master, the king of Assyria. I'll give you 200 horses if you're able to put on your part riders on them. So this is a taunt against the fact that the Israelis under Hezekiah are following God's directive of not using horses and chariots. They use foot soldiers, militiamen. And so he says, look, I'll bet you that even if I gave you the 2,000 horses, you couldn't come up with 2,000 horsemen. Verse number 9, how then can you repulse a single captain among the least of my master's servants when you trust in Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? So how do you even think you could take me on when you're going to have to reach out to Egypt for the rapid deployment of chariots and horses, because you don't even have them? Verse 10, moreover, is it without he who is that I've come up against this land to destroy it? He who is said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. And so now he just comes right out and lies that God has told him, actually told his master, to go and take this country. So Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah said to Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. Don't speak to us in the land of Judah within the hearing of the people who are on the wall. So now we find out that Rabshakeh, either he personally or through a translator that he's using, is speaking Hebrew rather than the Aramaic, which is the language of the Assyrian Empire. And so the three leaders that are representing Hezekiah ask him, please don't talk to us in Hebrew. We don't need the people up on the wall hearing what you have to say to us. Let's just keep this between us. And this might be the reason why Hezekiah picked these three guys to meet with Rabshakeh, because they are all three of them conversant in Aramaic. Now, there is an interesting twist that happens here in Israeli history. After the Assyrian exile, and then the Babylonian exile that follows it, the ethnic Israelis who live for several generations in Mesopotamia start using Aramaic as their own natural language. And Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, becomes kind of the language of the scholars, the scribes. And when they come back to Judea underneath their new king or their new prince, Zerubbabel, the Judeans of that period will speak Aramaic as their natural language. And that will be true all the way up to the time of Jesus, that the Jewish people will speak Aramaic, which is related to Hebrew, but it's not exactly the same. And so this is kind of a weird twist here, that Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah say, hey, don't talk to us in Hebrew because we don't want all the Hebrew people to understand. Talk to us in Aramaic, which they don't understand. Verse number 12, but Rabshakeh said back to them, has my master sent me to speak these words to your master and to you, and not to the men sitting on the wall who are doomed with you to eat their dung and drink their own urine? So he totally blows them off, and he keeps speaking in Hebrew, and he even makes it a bigger deal. He starts telling them, hey, are you saying you don't want these guys that are up here listening to me to know that they're going to end up digging through their own poop to try to find something to eat because they're so hungry, and they're going to be trying to drink their own pee because they are so thirsty? You don't want them to hear that? And so Rabshakeh then stood and called out in a loud voice in the language of Judah. So this is all in Hebrew, the common language of all the people up on the wall. Hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you. Do not let Hezekiah make you trust in he who is by saying, he who is will surely deliver you. This city will not be given into the hands of the kings of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah. For thus says the king of Assyria, make your peace with me. Come out to me. Then each one of you will eat of his own vine, and each one of you will eat of his own fig tree, and each one of you will drink the water of his own cistern until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and wine, a land of bread and vineyards. So this is Rabshakeh's appeal on behalf of the Assyrian kingdom to the Judeans. If you will just surrender yourselves, surrender the city of Jerusalem, surrender the kingdom of Judah over into the Assyrian Empire, if you will just do that, we won't have to come in here with an army and fight you. And you can all go back to your homes and eat and drink out of your own properties until we relocate you. And we will relocate you to a beautiful place, a place that will feel like home to you, a place where you can have grain and wine and bread and vineyards, just like you have here. Because remember, the Assyrians have this procedure that they've adopted, that whenever they take over a new area, they shuffle the population around to somewhere else. And then they shuffle in to that newly conquered area, people from other areas. And this just kind of keeps the people off kilter. It keeps them out of balance and makes it less likely that they're going to rebel. And even perhaps gives them the sense, we're going to give you new, better places to live. And so Sennacherib, through the Rabshakeh, is making peace overtures that will lead to relocation. Verse 18. Beware lest Hezekiah mislead you by saying, he who is will deliver us. Has any of the gods of the nations delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamat and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharim or Sepharvaim? And the answer is, naturally, to be understood, they didn't help those guys out because those people have now been relocated into northern Israel. Their gods didn't save them. Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? That is, did the golden calves, did Baal and Asherah, did they deliver the northern Israelis from the Assyrian hands and being relocated to northern Assyria? No. Verse 20, who among all the gods of these lands has delivered their lands out of my hand, that he who is should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? So from the Rabshakeh's viewpoint, from Sennacherib's viewpoint, from Sargon II's viewpoint, Ashur is the only god that counts, the god of Assyria. All other gods and goddesses have to bow to Ashur. And the people who serve those now subservient gods and goddesses have to serve Assyria. And Judah, Rabshakeh says, is not going to be an exception to that rule. Your god is going to have to bow before our God. Verse 21, but they, meaning the Jews up on the walls, were silent and answered him not a word, for the king's command was, do not answer him. So don't talk to him. Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him the words of Rabshakeh. So they come back and make their full report with grief. And of course, Hezekiah has the same reaction. As soon as King Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of he who is. Now, I think it would have been good for him to do this earlier instead of paying any of the tribute money. Verse 2, and he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, and Shebna the secretary, and the senior priest, covered with sackcloth, to the prophet Isaiah the son of Amoz. So now they're bringing Isaiah into this story. They need him to talk to God. They said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this day is a day of distress, of rebuke, of disgrace. Children have come to the point of birth. There's no strength to bring them forth. It may be that he who is your God will hear the words of Rabshakeh, whom his master, the son of the king of Assyria, has sent to mock the living God, and will rebuke the works of Yahweh, he who is your God, has heard, and therefore lift up your prayer for the remnant that is left. So basically, Isaiah is being petitioned to step in and appeal to God not to let the Assyrians get away with this, not to let the Assyrians insult God by saying that he cannot save Jerusalem and Judea from the hands of the Assyrians and the hands of Ashur, their god, because God has already promised that Judah will not come under Assyrian control. And so when we come back tomorrow, we will see how God responds.